Okay.
There we go. Hello. We're recording.
Hello.
So, hi, my name is Brenda Martinez.
We're recording, and this is our first podcast.
Our first podcast. Yes.
Which means we don't know what we're doing.
Yes. Exactly. I'm a little bit nervous.
We should probably warn people. Yeah. And we should warn people straight out that this is not academic. You know, we're both clinicians that are, you know, doing a lot of continuous training, and I am an academic by training, but we're talking about like the nitty-gritty of doing the actual work, like the practice of it, like granular day in, day out of being with people and being, you know, working with people in relationships and, you know, people that are unpacking a lot of heavy stuff. So if people are wanting something that's really academic and theory focused, that's not us.
Nope.
And we're in the trenches. You should probably ask, like, warn them we're not going to. Yeah. And we're not going to be intentionally F-bomby, but, you know, we both are kind of ghetto hood rats with graduate degrees, and so F-bombs are gonna get dropped. Yeah,
for sure, for sure.
Yeah, I always love when people say that I'm doing it to try and sound cool, and I'm like I am res trash and a military brat, and like half my career has been in substance use. This is just what I sound like.
Definitely. So we're in the trenches, we're doing the difficult work. And we're all going to talk about something that I am really passionate about. I love this stuff, and I will talk to anybody about it. Talking about what I call thinking errors, toxic relational tactics from Faith's book. So that's going to be the topic for today. Where do we want to start? Do you want to kind of talk about how it came to be?
Yeah, so why don't we start with how this came up in our consultation group? This wasn't, so I ended up writing about this, but it started with you. You like, you brought in this thing, and I'm like, oh my God, what is this magic? I really dig this. You want to talk about kind of like what we were doing then, and then I can talk about where I went with that?
I don't remember. I just remember we were in the same consultation group, and I think that in consultation group, we would all bring up kind of cases that we were kind of wondering about. I think it started with Dan, right? And so we were kind of talking about a case, and I was like, hey, you know, this is really important for us to understand as therapists, because we need to understand where our clients are even when they call us, because that's, to me, that's important. We work with some really tough people, and I just always think we need to be able to see things as they're like right in front of us. So I had talked about bringing in what I call thinking errors to talk about with a group. And then I think
they were called like offender thinking errors, right? It came from your sex offender materials, offender thinking errors.
They're thinking errors for criminal and deviant thinking. And they do come out of my curriculum that I used when I was working with the sex offenders in a different program. And it was copyrighted, so I couldn't share it with anybody. But I let everybody look at it, and then I had to take it up. But, I shared it with everybody in Faith. I think you were there. You liked it.
Yeah.
Am I frozen?
You're kind of going in and out, just so people know that are watching this instead of listening to it. I live on the east side. I do not have good internet connection, no matter how much money I give them. And we had a really bad storm last night, so it's totally on my end. But so you brought this in, and I thought it was really cool. And I'm not a sex offender treatment provider. I mean, I've worked with people that have offended, but mostly working with, a lot of trauma and a lot of relational issues. I have a postdoc in sexology, so I'm working with sexual intimacy and, you know, relational issues. And I realized as you were talking about it, and I was like, I want a copy. And you're like, it's copyrighted. You can't have it. But I really am like super into this, because I realized that everybody could have this. Like, it's a matter of degree, but these ways of being, these thinking errors that lead to these behavioral patterns and relationships were something that I could relate to working with people that weren't even offenders. Right. And so, I went up, I ended up putting it in like my workbooks, which, you know, like, we're not pimping. I mean, you can buy it if you want, but that's where I ended up publishing it, because I got really into it. So I went, because I am an academic, went back and did original research on it. Yours had come from Safer Society Foundation, was where you had gotten your materials. But then, like, the University of Iowa had done some work on it. There's a type of therapy called moral recognition therapy. And they had done some stuff on it. And I said, what if we, like, expand this out and talk about it in terms of, like, these toxic relational patterns and them having, like, this spectrum of, you know, offender behavior at one end, and just like, this is kind of how I see the world, and it's something that I'm always having to work with in relationships on the other end, and ended up with like this big 7-page list. And I think you were like, of course you turned it into that. But yeah. I've had a lot of people say that it was interesting. And I mean, even the way I share it is like, we all have this stuff that we do. And I talk about myself in terms of that, and this, like this is something that I do that I have to pay attention to. Like, this is kind of my go-to way of seeing the world, but it is a toxic relational pattern for me. If I engage in the behaviors around it, I'm being shitty to my partner. I'm not being an authentic self. I'm being reactive and trying to control my environment with this behavior. And that's the part that's not okay. You know, yeah. I tell people all the time, like, you're not responsible for your first thought. Like, we have these automatic thoughts for a reason, but you are responsible for your second thought and your first behavior. Yeah. So when that comes up for you, you're just like, oh, that's jacked up. I shouldn't do that. Right. And then you do something else.
Yeah.
That's kind of the work we're doing.
I typically frame it as on a continuum. And so even victims, and you did the research, we both did the research on the criminal stuff because of the presentations that we're doing, I think, in March, or we're supposed to do in March. But it's on a continuum. Victims engage in some of these thinking errors because that's what they were taught growing up, and they were engaging in that with the family systems that they were in. So they too use them. So I typically do a lot of education on thinking errors with victims, but also with my offenders. And it's really beneficial in helping them kind of recognize, like, this is what I've taken on and this is what I've bought into. And part of that recovery process is to be able to work through it, kind of like you were talking about, Faith, is like recognizing your own shit, recognizing it, understanding where it's coming from, and making a very conscious...
Yeah, and on the worksheet itself, I have... Oh, go ahead. See, you're buffering, so I'm interrupting you and being pink crappy because I can't hear you. Sorry, go ahead.
I forget what I was saying. Just that I think that we do the work to help people have a more conscious response to their recovery versus kind of that subconscious, that unhealthy learned behavior and thinking when they're coming from a system that is dysfunctional or unhealthy. So go ahead, Faith. What were you going to say?
Yeah. Well, and I was going to say, so the worksheet itself, there are spaces for it because when I present this to people and you do the same thing, like, we all have this. When you're working with victims doing trauma recovery work, you're still talking about the same thing. So this isn't a... And I hedge away from writing about a lot of topics because I don't want people to go, ha ha, I read this book and Dr. Faith says you're a narcissist. I knew it. You know, I don't want to, you know, be putting that kind of stuff out there. So I write about things in terms of the behaviors and where they come from versus the labely type stuff. So in talking about this, I'm like, is this something, like, the first thing is, this is something that you do? Like, this isn't just about, like, oh, are the people around you doing it? But is this, like, something that you do? And taking that kind of self-responsibility, is this stuff that you saw in your family of origin? Is this stuff that's happened to you in past relationships? Or is this in your current relationship? So that also gives people a chance of seeing the patterns and going, oh yeah, this was the attachment style that I had growing up. And so that's carrying forward. You know, I had this very insecure attachment style. It was very disorganized in my family. And so I'm carrying forward into these toxic strategies later on. So you can really see patterns of behavior by going, oh, I do this because it happened in my family, or this continues to happen in my relationships. So why am I continuing to make these choices about people that I decide to be with? And I think that's really important of the work. It's not just my boyfriend is a narcissist because Faith and Brenda said so.
Right. Absolutely. And I think that's too, I have to warn all of my clients that when we go over this isn't about well, the way that I do that exercise is a little bit different, but I always have to kind of tell them, like, this isn't about anybody else but you. And I always we always have to, at least I do in recovery, it is about you. It's not about anybody else. But the work that we do is grounded in looking outside of us and, like, where did we learn all of this? And how do we unconsciously continue to perpetuate these things in our lives that sabotage our happiness, our relationships, our jobs, all of those things? So it's always really interesting to do, because I think on my end, I think one of the great things about doing it is that you do begin to see patterns. At least clinically, I can see them. And then I can kind of point them out to my client, and then they're made aware of it. Recovery is about being aware. And then we're able to kind of move forward in a very seamless way, because they get it and they understand it. They just don't know how to change it, right? That's the tough part, is they don't know how to change it. So it's a very, very, very interesting. I love it.
Yeah. Well, and I tell people too, you know, the same thing about awareness. I said, things fundamentally change once you start paying attention to them. It's like when you put a slide under the microscope, you have to turn on this light so you can see what's on the slide. And we're doing the same thing with thoughts and our feelings and our behaviors. We're turning on the light and going, oh, what is that? And that, I mean, that is a good three quarters of the work right there, of like, oh, there it is, there's my shit. And then you know, okay, so now I need to find strategies to work with it. But if you're not aware of what's going on, that I'm reliving these attachment issues. And I wrote a lot about attachment issues in my boundaries book for that reason, because a lot of our issues come from our early attachment styles. Right. Oh yeah, that's a thing that I do, so I need to do something with it. Like, the one of the ones on the list is called the what do they call it specifically? Fairness violation. Mm-hmm. And I use this as an example with clients. I'm like, I was born with a that's unfair rule in my head. Like, I came out deciding that things were unfair and the world was mean to me. Like, sometimes it's just how we are. I was that kid that would, like, watch my mom, you know, those little chaffa popsicles that we had back in the 70s and 80s that had two sticks, and our moms were poor, so they, like, cut them in half and you each got a half. And I was measuring to see who got the bigger half. Like, and yeah, it had to be, like, I was that person from the get-go. And so that, like, being aware of that I've decided that this is a fairness violation against me, is like, I can end up being toxic. Yeah. With a partner by deciding, like, well, this isn't fair. You know, you did the dishes, but I got the trash and fed the cats and picked up the dry cleaning, you know, and right, start getting into this list. And rather than, hey, I use more help right now, I was a little overloaded, or just, like, they're busy too. And so, you know, I had more flexibility in my schedule, and that's cool. And he'll pick up more next week or whatever. And realizing that, you know, one of my rules about the world is everything needs to be fair, and good luck with that, and paying attention to it has helped me not react from that place. So I always tell clients that, like, that is specifically one of mine. Right. And that it's okay. Like, the stuff we all do, it's what we do with it that is the issue in the end.
I think it's always important also to recognize that, like, for you, if you're using the fairness violation, how that leads into additional thinking errors, right? And so that's where we start seeing that toxic relational patterns, because we're stacking them, because you start off with the fairness violation, but then you tap into keeping score, which is like, now it's tit for tat. Now I'm going to do this because you did that, and I'm going to be justified, which is the other thing, in doing those things. And so now I feel entitled to do them because you did that thing and it was unfair to me, and this is how I'm going to even that score. So stacking them, you know, we can get really like a tornado in all of that dysfunction.
This wasn't fair. So, right. I'm allowed to take money out of your wallet and do blah, 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 because you didn't pick up the cleaning, and, like, all that shit that can spiral, that, you know, brains are really good at justifying shit. I think one of the, like, when people are like, so other than, like, fairness violation, like, what is a toxic relational strategy? I think the one that everybody's become super aware of in the past couple years is the idea of gaslight. That'd be the one that I see the most media on.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that one might be helpful for people. Like, you know what gaslighting is. And I think we've all had the experience of like having been with somebody like, oh my God, that person was gaslighting me. And that is a total example of a toxic relational strategy of like this mechanism of control of another individual that isn't based on honest communication about wants and needs. And like, I'm going to control this person's perspective and their behavior by gaslighting them. I'm sure you get a lot of that too.
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah. Definitely. And I like that there are new kind of all of this information coming out, but there's so much of it. I think that it is hard. Like gaslighting is just one aspect of that. And when me and you look at it, we're looking at, I have a list of 60 thinking errors. I know your list is 7 pages long. I focus on 27, 6 of them with my clients because it does the job of helping them to understand what it means. I wish like everybody knew this because awareness is so important, especially in recovery. And as therapists, I think it's important because we're human. We can be manipulated if we don't know and understand where or what our client's intent is, because that's a lot of the work that I do is, you know, looking at intent, not just behavior. That's a lot of the work in terms of moral compassing work we do. Is to readjust some of that. So looking at intent. So it's really, really interesting. I love it. That's why I love this topic. I love it. You're frozen, Faith. Uh-oh. So as I was talking, Faith dropped off. You're back. Can you hear me?
I dropped. Do you have, okay. Yep, I dropped. East side. And people are like, you need to move. And I'm like, I am trying.
So I was
and just. I realized.
Go ahead.
Oh, you were talking about like the 6 main ones that you use from the list. And that also kind of like made me remember too. Like we should probably, people think of thinking errors or thinking of like that traditional cognitive behavioral therapy, which I also use. And I know you do too, especially coming from community mental health and CBT being that gold standard. But these are ones that are specific in relationship. And I think that's the big difference. And we're talking about whether we're calling it, offender thinking errors, toxic relational pattern, whatever. We're talking about these things that we do in relationship versus, all or nothing thinking, black and white thinking kind of stuff, which is a singular internal process versus something that we then impose on others in terms of our behavior. For those the people that are CBT going, what is the difference here? That might be helpful.
Do you
want to talk about like the 6 main ones that you use, the ones that you kind of go to over and over again?
Well, I have 26. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we can do it out of your book because that's what I have right now.
Do you have main ones that you notice a lot?
Yeah. The justifying. Justifying. I don't know. Do you have that in the book? Because I know there was some in here ownership. I mean, all kinds. Like I said, the keeping score is one that I look at.
Mm-hmm. Justifying is definitely in here. And that's when we justify our behavior so we don't have to take responsibility for our actions. I wouldn't have hit you if you hadn't have made me so angry.
Right.
You are responsible for my emotional content. If you don't make me angry, then I don't have to hit you. It's sort of that's kind of a classic.
One. Yeah, definitely. And that's one of
what was the other one you just mentioned?
I think we use that in as well with, because I do want to differentiate. I use the CBT ones, which are what you were talking about in terms of singular for anxiety and depression, which is very different than the ones for criminal thinking and deviant thinking. Yeah.
And I have some of the CBT thinking errors, I think, in my depression book just for that reason, because it's about that depression spiral that we get ourselves into based on sort of the cognitions we're doing, but it's very much an internalized process. Oh my God, you're such a piece of shit. And it's not about how we're controlling other people.
Right. I mean, I think in my recovery work, when I work with depression, there is some deviant thinking there. as well, because they, you know, when I do all my education, we're talking about a mental filter, right? And so it's filtering through everything that we think is filtering through this distortion. And so even for some people who are depressed, in order to feel better, they will engage in deviant thinking, as a way to feel better. Mm-hmm. Right. So there, everything is so connected,
connected. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really, that's why I love it though. Cause it's so
that would be one that, it's so interesting. And that would be a place where you would be using both, saying, okay, so these are the toxic relational patterns. Let's how are you getting there? Is it your own thinking patterns because of your depression and anxiety? Is it attachment style because of stuff that you grew up with?
Right.
I've had a lot of clients come to me realizing that I thought I was in this really good place, but I realized when I'm not feeling good about myself, when my own depression is bad, I start doing the things that like my father did. And those are very hurtful to my partner. I'm going to make myself feel better by having this affair. And I'm realizing that this came from the fact that I wasn't feeling good about myself, you know? And so that's kind of that, having to do the, if we're going to use dialectical behavioral therapy, the chain analysis, how did I get here? It's not a simple path, and having to kind of unwind all that. And that's what therapy is, right? We have the perspective of going wait, did this before your mom died or after? And people are like, oh shit, that was right after. Duh, that makes sense. That's what the perspective of therapy is. Going, wait a minute, you've said that word four times. What is up with that word? And people go, right?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Yes. For people who are, concerned about therapy,
being able to pick up on that, I think, is really important. That's why it's important for us to know this stuff. Because it helps us be better clinicians to understand. So, well, I guess let's go over some of them. So we did the justifying, which ones do you want to go? Because I know, like I said, the 26 that I use is like power play. Power play is when we are bossy, but we're willing to do anything to essentially win in quotations. The person willing to do anything, manipulate, lie in order to achieve their goal in power play. Do you have that one? Mm-hmm. You call that one.
And I don't think I call it that. I have it in there, not under that term.
Yeah.
But it is, it's definitely in here. If I look for it immediately, of course I won't find it, but, one of the ones in here that I have bumped into a lot, and I know you have too, and this is one thing that my editor is not being a clinician. She's always super fast. This is one of the things that she's like, wait, what? That's so, I never even thought about that way. Was anger as a means of control.
Oh, I love
that. And this is one of those little clinical tricks.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when we use anger to control and manipulate the behavior of others, and this is where she got really interested. I said, there's different kinds of anger. There's an impulsive anger where people have a really hard time controlling their anger response. Mm-hmm. But then when it's a manipulative anger, when people get what they want with that kind of anger, the anger shuts off. If you have if you really have a clinical problem with anger and you have this impulsive anger, getting what you want doesn't turn off the anger. Yeah. You're still mad because you don't have control over your emotional response.
Right.
When anger is used to get what you want, all right, fine, here's your ice cream. And the kid calms down immediately. Yeah. That is a different thing. And that's one of those things that we're always sort of looking for clinically, is when somebody has an anger problem, what happens to the anger when that desire is met? Is that little thing that we're always looking for there.
Right. And so when I talk about that one, so I actually say they pretend to be angry, because that's really what it is that they're manipulating what we know as the response to anger, which is aggression a lot of times, right? They're going to step up to somebody, they're going to yell, they're going to get a real mean face. Those are the behaviors that we can associate.
They're going to punch a wall to show you what they could do to you.
Right.
Yes.
Right. And so people learn that aggression works, unfortunately, but we know that that's true. So people will use and take advantage of people's fear of the behavior and pretend to be angry to get what they want. And the great example is a child who is like throwing tantrums and soon mom, you know, there's that great video from, I don't know how long ago, where there's a kid throwing a tantrum, you know, flailing on the floor, but mom walks away and he stops, gets up, and then goes in front where mom can see him again to start flailing and crying. And people fall into that deviant way of thinking in order to be able to get their needs met in an unhealthy, unsafe way. And again, because they're using that and the expression of aggression as a way to manipulate and coerce others, that's where it becomes that toxic relational behavior, because people will be fearful. I mean, we get scared when, I mean, as a woman, I think we get a little bit fearful when we start seeing aggression out there with men. And so, of course, then we're going to be fearful. And absolutely, it does. Part of the grooming process, which is connected to all of this, is when somebody uses anger as a deviant thinking pattern, and they do it again, like you were talking about, in front of somebody else or hitting a wall, to reinforce the fear so that they can groom someone into abuse. So all of those things are connected. It's so wonderful. It's so interesting. So yeah, anger is a good one to talk about.
Yeah. And that is, I mean, for those of you listening, that's the big therapy trick. So you don't have to spend $200,000 on student loan debt. We're looking for what happens when the need is met or not met, what happens to the anger in that situation. Because I've worked with people that, you know, and you have too, that are maybe bipolar, and manic can express itself as anger. In fact, it frequently does. It's not, you know, happy fun manic just going to Vegas. It becomes this uncontrollable anger, and you can give them whatever they, you know, think that they're originally mad about, but the anger has still already gone off like wildfire. And that is a very different thing than that pretend anger, that right. Using the anger to manipulate a situation where the behavior feels threatening.
No, definitely. So I know that there's differences in terms of, I think you had said that, you know, I guess different levels, but like, again, on that continuum, even when I work with people who are in recovery from like mental health, like bipolar, depression, or severe anxiety, you know, they're on that continuum of using these things to get their needs met. And it's important for us to understand like where they are, and to help them find a healthier and safer way to kind of function in their relationships, because oftentimes they do come in because they're recognizing that relationally there's some issues there, and they may not always recognize that they are contributing to some of that issue with their own deviant thinking. For most of the people that I work with now, it is deviant thinking. It's not criminal thinking. Most of the people that I'm working with now are not engaging in criminal behavior, like I had been working with before in my other program. So it is interesting, because working with self-proclaimed offenders, people who have engaged in domestic violence, who have engaged in like child abuse, sexual abuse, they too are on that continuum. And I remember very early on, I have a packet of stuff that I do with my clients. So I'd gone over this packet with my clients, and he was, you know, a self-proclaimed offender. He recognized he engaged in domestic violence as the offender. And he was shocked because we had gone through it all, and he had progressed, and he was in recovery, and he understood, and he didn't want to engage in those behaviors anymore. But he said, you know, this is like a packet of how to be an offender. He's like, I did everything in this packet, not recognizing that it was unhealthy and unsafe. He's like, I was shocked to go through this stuff and to realize that I'm doing everything unhealthy and unsafe. So I recognize that some people do want to change. Some people don't know how. And people who are some of this thinking don't want to change, because I've also worked with people who actually enjoy being an offender. And who don't have a problem with it. And they like, this is how I get what I want. So I don't have a problem with it. And those guys tend to drop out because I am so big about personal accountability. But it is important to, I love this topic. I just love it. So do we want to go over some more? Do you want to pull one out?
Yeah, I was looking. I was kind of flipping through the list. There's one on here that was one that I added to this because it's something that I'm really passionate about, and I know you are too. And this was just one of the ones that I added to the list. And it was the spiritual philosophical bypassing.
I was just looking at that one. Huh? I was just looking at that. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Yes. When we invoke religion or spirituality, and we're laughing because these are conversations that Brenda and I've had so many times over the years. So when we're invoking our religion, our spirituality over our personal responsibility in attempt to ascribe different meaning to a situation, yeah, or just to avoid doing the work around uncomfortable emotions. And we've all met that person like, oh, that's just God's will. I'm turning it over to God. I'm praying about it. It can be philosophical. You can be a hardcore atheist. And like, that was one of the examples I gave in here too. Like, what does this really even mean at a constructivist level anyway? But it's basically separating yourself out from your bullshit by ascribing it higher meaning or lack of meaning rather like than doing your work. And we see it probably most likely religion, but I've seen people do it philosophically as well.
Yeah.
There's a really good book called Spiritual Bypassing. That's where the term came from.
Yeah. I think people early, where I see it most is where, and I don't want to pick on anybody, but where I see it most is where people are getting out of jail or prison, you know, and they have found God and they've realized mm-hmm. they want to change. And they, you know, they will kind of talk about those things to the parole board as a way to, again, manipulate because they don't really buy into it. But they're saying it to their family members as a way to get their family members to back off. And, you know, they'll use it as a way to manipulate, like, well, I believe in God now. And so you should back off and not hold me accountable because only God can judge me. When we think about sexual abuse, some people will use, you know, God as, you know, a husband or a wife needs to submit to their husband as a way to manipulate and coerce their partners into sexual contact or anything else that they want to do. So definitely it's not just Christian. I call it Christian values, as a manipulation, as a way to manipulate others, but also using professional language, distancing ourselves so that we don't have to be responsible. We call it Perry Mason because it's based on that show. Yeah. But I'm going to use this language as a way to distance myself from being responsible. Yeah. So I'm going to use, you know, the Christian values or spiritual bypassing as a way to distance myself from being responsible. I'm going to use professional language because people do that too. People use really fancy words as a way to get other people to back off.
And on the list, there's playing defense attorney. And then I had like several different ways of playing defense attorney under the Perry Masoning. I think that was the original term on your original list, like the harm discounting, the frequency minimization. It didn't happen five times. It happened like once, you know, that justice seeking, all of those ways are ways of trying to lawyer our way out of something too. Semantics. Yeah, it's all those ways that we try to divert a topic by getting into semantics. And I see clients, you know, I work with couples like, it did not happen 10 times, it happened 7 times. And I'm just like, okay, well, I wasn't there, so be that as it may, it's a problem, you know?
Right.
I just don't get involved in semantics games working with individuals. And
Yeah, definitely.
And their partners are very used to doing that. No, it was 9 times, and I can show you because we were on vacation. And I'm like, I don't give a shit. Like, that's not the point.
Right. Yeah, they want to show you text messages. No, it doesn't matter. Yeah. I promise you. We're going to continue to move forward. You can acknowledge it happened. Let's look at the impact. This is the impact, right? And so then we have to move them into a place of taking accountability for their own behavior and how that's either going to be toxic, unhealthy, unsafe within the context of a relationship. So,
Yeah. And I think that, I mean, the spiritual bypassing, you know, that this is God's will. We've both seen like a lot of victims, you know, take that on. Like there's some kind of greater meaning, like this is God's will. And this person needs a strong partner who can handle this because they're in a lot of pain. And so, you know, they hit me sometimes, but it's God's will that I be this strong partner for the, I mean, a lot of victims are, I mean, most victims are not weak. They're actually very, very strong. And they think that they then are supposed to be the strong person
right.
In this abusive relationship. And I say pretty regularly, like, God is not an asshole. Like, that's not how this works. Yeah. I mean, bad things happen because bad things happen, and God is in how we respond to it, not in the action. Like, God is not causing earthquakes, so we learn a lesson. God did not want you to get the shit beat out of you by your partner.
Right.
God is the work that comes after. And sometimes we can find a greater meaning in something, and that's a really beautiful thing when we do that, but that's not the point, you know. Bad things happen because bad things happen is probably something I say 5 times a week. You probably do too. At some point.
Yeah. Well, I'll often tell my clients.
And I don't mind, you know,
I must be lagging. So I was just going to say that I think that when I talk to my clients, you know, especially when it's kind of that God thing, is I say the same thing, like, I can't see God wanting to see you here being abused, like, because they can reference the Bible, and I say, well, yeah, but the other part of that scripture is that a husband is supposed to submit to his wife. So did you ever hear that part? And they'll say, of course not. Okay, of course not. I mean, because that's because they're engaging in this toxic relational pattern to maintain control over you. And so then they get it, and they begin to really kind of understand, like, what other manipulative things is he doing, right? Or has he done for me to maintain this kind of relationship? And I love that part, because I love helping people understand. And I think even with the spiritual stuff, I mean, you know, being able to talk about that stuff, because I'm like, your partner is using the Bible and or God as a way to harm you. Like, how much logic does that make? If when we think about God, it's like healthy and safe and wanting to be a unit together, like y'all aren't, because he's always in charge. Like, he's the one telling you you're a dumb whore because you went to the grocery store without him, right? So it's all of that stuff that they kind of get to recognize as those toxic relational tactics that people use. So what were you going to say?
Yeah. Essentially the same thing. And I think that sometimes therapists shy away from those conversations, especially if there is a different religious tradition. This can be true in any religion. There can be that radicalized or very conservative or very insular sect of any religious faith or practice that creates these kind of mechanisms. And so being able, I think it's really helpful to have some kind of background in that and be able to say, like, okay, so I'm not a practicing Muslim. This is only what I know and don't know. But being able to be open to those conversations. I really like the book, God is Not One, Stephen Prothero book, which is a professor of religious studies. And so he kind of talks about the differences. I think that's a really good kind of multicultural book. But I think that in being careful about respecting beliefs, we've shied away from these conversations a lot of times as therapists, and we need to, like, okay, so tell me what that means for you. Like, you know, well, my religion says I need to stay with him, and I'm like, well, the Bible also says you should weave your own clothes, but both of our sweaters came from Target, so there we go. You know, we need to be able to have those kinds of conversations. If I'm not challenging something that is authentic, but let's unpack it a little bit. What does that actually mean? You know, and you know, what does that actually look like? And, you know, I'm a preacher's kid. And so I've actually have discussed, you know, scripture and, you know, sanctity of marriage and all those things. And I'm comfortable doing that. And, you know, if you're seeing a therapist or you are a therapist and that's not your thing, having, you know, kind of building some more efficacy in that way is useful. And, you know, being able to refer to somebody who can do that, but also tell people, like, this is obviously an important part of your life. Help me understand this for you. When you say that my religion says that I should do that, like, where does that come from? And where did you hear that message? And what does that mean for you? And like you said, well, the Bible also says this. So, you know, what does that mean? And kind of unpack and having you know, my parents were also religious scholars. So it was always very like, think of this for yourself. And we would have very deep conversations about, my dad is a Roman Catholic deacon and an ecumenical Catholic priest. And my mom was a spiritual director. So they would talk about, you know, the catechesis. So they would talk about the lower C Catholicism versus the big C Catholicism, meaning the church. And like, they wanted me to understand and speak to those things. And I think we've gotten so nervous about being offended that we don't understand that stuff and can't speak to it well with clients anymore. And I'm not a practicing Catholic anymore, but I can have those conversations with people.
Right.
I mean, I've had people actually come in. Yeah.
I did a training with, here in San Antonio with, I think, Casey Howard on, you know, incorporating spirituality into treatment, because I think it's such an important component of who we are as people, right? So like, you're not Catholic now, but you have this great knowledge. I am Catholic. But people are kind of in the middle, you know, it's on, again, it's like on a spectrum, right? So whether we're atheist or we're Muslim or we're Protestant or Catholic, like that's such an important component of who we are. And when somebody's using this deviant thinking to control them and coerce them, it is a value system for them. It is something that they will buy into just in the nature of their religion. And what this leader, you know, as a partner or as a father is telling them. So they are really tough conversations because we're touching stuff that for them is deep seated in their value system in terms of religion. And so it is important to,
and I don't, I mean, I've never had anyone come back and tell me that they were super offended.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
I was like, I've never had anyone tell me like they were offended by that conversation. There might have been. I mean, but my clients are usually pretty good about, because they know, like, if they don't like something I say, they can be like, that's dumb. And I mean, I've worked with people that, you know, come from Muslim communities, arranged marriages, and I have nothing but respect for, you know, that path, or it's about when it becomes a harmful part of the relationship. So when people are, they come in and they're like, so like, you know, we're here on work visas and we have this arranged marriage. I'm like, that's awesome. That tends to work better than the way we do it here in the US. Tell me about, you know, and so we can still respect all these different paths, even if they're not ours, but just saying, okay, so this is where it's become a problem.
Yeah.
This is where, this is not healthy. This is not okay. God is not an asshole. This is not the plan for you.
Right. Definitely.
And I've never had anyone be upset at me for having those conversations.
Yeah. And I think that working with, because I've worked with people who have been separated from cults. I mean, they are incredibly thankful that they have this information, because again, it touches that value system for them. And there's a lot of guilt and shame connected to it for something that that is not theirs. You know, I talk to my clients about, this is not yours. This is this person's who was abusive and coercive and manipulative. That's not yours. That's theirs. And so it helps clients really kind of give responsibility to where it goes, instead of internalizing it as theirs, that somehow they were not good Christians or whatever, you know, sect or religion they're from, but somehow they're not good because they don't like what's happening. They are able to give it back to the people who it belongs to, which are the criminal and deviant people that are engaging in that abusive behavior. So it gets very deep.
It's very, very deep.
Yeah.
So that's if it's not, don't carry other people's shit for them.
Yeah.
I like doing that. I actually had a conversation with a client a couple of weeks ago. I'm like, they're still in high school. So I'm like, if you sign off on your like philosophy credit, like this was a big philosophical conversation that we just had right now. So if you want like class credit for that, I'll totally sign off on philosophy. I end up doing a lot of that. Because we have like, these are all about, you know, we have these meaning making systems, and these thinking errors can become our meaning making system and allow these negative behaviors, or we can, we can unpack them you know, and even like what you said with the cults is when, you know, when we know better, we do better. And for your people that have been offenders that are in recovery for that, okay, you know better. You can go, oh, that's like several generations worth of shit that I don't have to do anymore. I can, you know, beat myself up for it, or I can go, whoa, where did that come from? And how do I, you know, do differently in the future? You know, when we know better, we do better is kind of one of the things. There are certain things that I probably say several times a week, and that's definitely one of them. Because we have a tendency to beat ourselves up for like, why did I stay in the cult that long? Because, you know, because you did. There was a lot of reasons for that, and we can unpack that to make sure it doesn't happen again. But beating yourself up for it is not going to give you that time back.
Right. And I definitely have conversations with people about feeling guilty because I work with the offender on the offender side. Who do feel a sense of guilt and who beat themselves up. And we really talk about how can you honor your recovery with making very conscious choices about being healthy and safe with your family members who are still there for you, who are, you know, your new relationships or your children. Mm-hmm. Like, how can you really honor that with making healthy and safe conscious decisions to continue to move forward and away from that deviant thinking, even though they may not believe you, right? Because I know early in recovery, people always tell me, like, people are telling me, like, who the fuck do you think you are? Like, oh, all of a sudden you're better than us. That happens because as you try to make change and you
don't mean you're not going drinking anymore. Same thing. Yeah.
You don't engage in the same thinking. People are like, who the fuck are you? Like, so, you know, so it's part of
helping. And that even like, because it doesn't feel comfortable, you know, anybody in the system change.
You can finish.
Oh, sorry. We're buffering. People probably think I'm being like a continuous rude ass bitch. And I am sometimes, but it's just buffering. So I'm missing stuff. I don't even remember what I was saying now, but yeah, no, I was saying that anytime anybody in the system changes that, you know, that's like, you know, hitting one into the spider web, the whole thing vibrates and that can be uncomfortable even when it's a positive change. You're changing other people's role. So if you were, you know, the person when the offender was the addict and other people were in the caretaker role or in a denial role or whatever, then their role is also being challenged or their own behaviors are being challenged. And that's why like in AA, they're like, hey, new places, new faces is a big thing, is because it's really difficult sometimes to be in old systems where people don't like that change in you. And that can be really hard to do.
Yeah.
So, and I think a lot of that is the self-compassion work, and people think self-compassion is the letting yourself off the hook. And actually self-compassion is huge accountability, but deep accountability, not spiritual bypassing accountability, which would probably be like a whole other podcast. Maybe that's the next one we should do, is talking about like the self-compassion works. I use that a lot. Yeah. And I tell people like, I don't know how to do easy work. I only know how to do really hard work, and I can be with you in the hard work, and I do my own hard work. Self-compassion is hard work.
I'd say the same thing to like new clients, you know, like, hey, because I do phone consultations because I'm like, I'm not for everybody. Like the work that we do is intense. You know, it's not easy work. I'm not going to sit here and bullshit with you for an hour. Like I am an intense clinician. My job is to help you to feel better. So we're going to do the hard work. I'm going to be pointing out stuff. And if you can't handle that, then I'm not the therapist for you. So most people are like, that's what I need. But you know, it is really tough work, hard to be soft, you know, when you've had to be hard for so long. But we can definitely learn and we can teach our clients how to do it. But you know, we have to have, I think the understanding too. So do you want to go over a different thinking error? Because I think we kind of lost track. We were on spiritual bypassing, and it's such a like a, I think such a great topic that we kind of got off. But
it's a big thing, yeah. Yeah, and of course the takeaway from that is like, if you want therapy as a rent a friend, if you want to sit on somebody's couch and cry every week, that neither one of us are the therapist for you. But the important part of that is when I tell people, am I nice? They're like, no. And I'm like, so if I'm telling you, you busted your ass and you did a really good job and I'm proud of you, can you believe it? And they're like, oh, that's fair. Because I don't do like nice and fluffy. If I praise the shit out of you, please take that as a truth.
Yeah.
yeah, we probably have enough time to go over like one more. Is there anyone in particular you wanted to go over? And I think we should do self-compassion next, because that's one of my little personal soapboxes. Oh, this is a good one. Playing dumb.
Oh, I love that. Dumb. That was one of my favorites.
We act confused about a situation to avoid responsibility for our behavior, or continuously ask questions that imply we don't understand what others are communicating. What did they do? What's wrong with that? What do you mean by that? My God. Yes, all the time. And that's one of those continuum whens. Like, you know, what is it? Why are you so upset? That's one of those ones that can be done at a very basic level and carried off into behavior.
So there's two of those that are connected. There's what I call playing confused, and then being helpless. So it can start off with, I don't understand what you mean by that. I had a pretty intense experience with a coworker that did this. So it is, the effect that it has is, it can be devastating, but it's when somebody's pretending like they have no idea what's happening. They don't know that they were supposed to do something, like, oh, I didn't know I had to fill that out, or I had to do this, or I didn't know that. When it's very obvious, you know, the example that I use is like when you ask a kid to take the trash out. Simple, easy task, but then they're like, oh, that's what you meant. I didn't know that's what you meant. Like, what do you mean? Like, you've even done it before. And they're like, I didn't know. And then it becomes, well, I can't because I hurt my leg, which is the being helpless. So those two are really connected as well. Those are really interesting too. Pretending to be confused. I have clients that say, oh, that's just plain dumb. Yeah. So
yeah,
it's that and then helpless.
I mean, one thing that I do with couples with that, if somebody's doing the plain dumb, like, oh, I didn't understand, is I say, okay, so we all have to hear uncomfortable information sometimes. How do you best receive it? Like, if somebody needs to tell you something about yourself that you're not going to really like, how do you best receive that kind of feedback? How do you need them to explain something to you? So I give it back to the person playing dumb with their partner. It was like, okay, well, I need to sit down and not have distractions. And then they tell me X, Y, Z using I statements, whatever. I'm like, okay, so that's what they're going to do. So you're going to hear it next time. You know, and so it's not saying, you know, because I'll say, like, you know, your partner is willing to do interpretive dance, you know, whatever, so you can understand, but you have to, like, so you tell us how you need to hear it. Yeah. And so I mean, that's one of the things that I do with people. And I think that's a good thing that we can do with anybody. Like, if you've got somebody who's playing, I'm like, okay, so if I have to tell you something, how do you need to hear it? And for some people, it's legit. I have a friend who's autistic, does not respond well to text. Like, if people communicate by text, it becomes like this overwhelm overload and he misses stuff. And so he's like told his roommates, I need to have that as a conversation sitting at the table so I can understand what you're saying. I get into, you know, autistic overload when I'm trying to interpret a text. I don't do as well with it. So for some people, it's very, very legitimate. And for other people, it is a, you know, it's a mechanism of control. Right. And I think the best way to subvert it is, okay, be that as it may, how do you need to hear things? Because I need to be able to tell you things.
Yeah.
I mean, however, I'll send it. And I've had, like, I will stand on the table and do an interpretive dance. I don't care, but I need you to be able to hear it. So you tell me how you need to be able to hear it. So it's giving people responsibility back for their own processing behavior, giving them the benefit of the doubt that they really didn't get it. And also challenging the, so it's not getting even into a power struggle of like, you're playing dumb, stop your shit. It's like, okay, fine. You didn't get it. All right. How do you need to hear it? Is one thing that I use with couples a lot.
I think one of the tough things, though,
and I can tell when, and I can tell when somebody's been playing dumb because I can see in their face that they're then trapped. Yeah. Like, to me, it's really diagnostic when I'm like, okay, so how do you need to hear something? And you can see that shit on their face. They know that they're busted.
Yeah.
And they're not going to get away with it anymore.
Yeah. I think one of the challenges in working with those specific thinking errors, you know, because there's also like victim stance, poor me is thinking errors, which are very similar as well to kind of being helpless. But I think one of the challenges is that many people get really frustrated with someone who's playing confused, right? It's like, oh, I can just do it quicker, faster, and get it done.
I hate it.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so
they get off the hook. Yeah.
Yeah. And so one of the things that I talk about when people engage in that is I'll just ask them very simple questions, kind of similar to what you're saying, is like, okay, well, what part of that did you not understand? Mm-hmm. And so they wind up kind of getting caught and hearing themselves, because mm-hmm. sometimes that's an issue. What we hear mm-hmm. in our head seems mm-hmm. legit, but when we hear it come out of our mouth, all of a sudden we're like, oh, that sounded fucked up, right? So I get them to start saying these things so that they can recognize kind of like their own bullshit. And they're like, okay, yeah. Like, you kind of got me. Like, okay, like, I guess I did understand. I just didn't want to have to do it. And then they can always admit, which is part of that process of like, I want you here. I want you to be conscious about what you're thinking and what you're doing instead of playing dumb with your boyfriend because blah, 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 whatever. Because we want healthy relationships. People want healthy relationships. They just don't know how to get it.
Yeah.
They don't know how to function outside of what they are engaged in. Yeah. So confusion.
So we went over a few of them for people. If anyone's super interested, I'm lagging again. I swear I need to move just so I can have better internet. I was gonna say, like, it's been an hour, so we probably need to finish up. But if anyone's like super interested in the, you can find, like, if you kind of Google, you'll find a lot of these. I'm gonna, you know, I did put it in one of my workbooks. So if you have that workbook, the intimacy workbook, then that list is in there if it's something like that you're looking, you know, to use for yourself or explore further. And I think we should talk about self-compassion next time as kind of, yeah, that heavy lifting accountability work, you know, because people think of self-compassion as this, ooh, poor baby, and it's not. It's the hardest accountability work I've ever done.
Yeah.
And I've been using self-compassion for about a decade, and it's complicated work, and that's where I see a lot of big recovery, was people can internalize that. Yeah. And I just realized we never said the name of our fucking podcast.
Oh yeah, you want to
because that's very that is so Faith and Brenda. Let's talk for an hour with our new podcast and not people telling the people the name of it. And so this is what, because we were kind of spitballing, and when I came up with this one, and my husband, who does this kind of stuff for a living, was like, oh shit, that's good. I knew the title. So it's Smart People, Dumb Brains, because we're talking about how, you know, going with good intents, and how we get tripped up on our own wiring all the time, which is pretty much, this is why I don't get invited to parties. I talk about sex and trauma. You know, sort of like the talking about that stuff and how what we're having to overcome. You know, we're both trauma therapists at our core, and everything else comes from the trauma work.
Yeah.
Is, you know, pretty much the entirety of both of our careers is what's going on in your brain and how did you get to this because of it.
Yeah. I always tell people, like, our brain is the most phenomenal thing, but it's also as dumb as a rock. Like, it just kind of functions the way it knows how to function. So
yes.
Work is so hard because
somebody asked me, like, you know, what's the one sentence explanation for your book, the Unfuck Your Brain book? And I'm like, your brain job is not to make you happy. It's to keep you alive.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, that's really depressing. I'm like, but also very true. And so that's what we're having to, like, that lack of discrimination and all that wiring stuff that we're having to, and that's the mind level stuff that we're working on therapeutically all the time. So we will do self-compassion next, which is one of my things. Another reason I don't get invited to parties. I think that is a good one.
Yeah, that'll be
one of those things, like, self-compassion, mindfulness, all that stuff that sounds really simple and kind of Instagram inspo, but is actually really, really hard work to do.
It is hard work. I mean, so many times I'm told, I don't even know how to do that. Like, what does that even mean? Like, what does that even look like? Because it is, it's mm-hmm. so foreign to that critical mind that we have when we're coming from trauma. So it's so challenging to start incorporating and integrating into the way that our brain functions. So I love that work.
And, you know, Kristen Neff and Christopher Gerber have done so much work on self-compassion, and they have a 3-stage process. And I start with that. And I've actually added some of Marshall Rosenberg's work to that. Cause I kind of kept bumping into a stuck place with clients. So we can kind of talk about their original stuff in my little hack for it that I use frequently. And then all the other ways that you acted as well. Cause it's one of those things like, okay, compassionate. You know, just be nice to yourself, stupid. See, you're not even being nice to yourself. You suck at, you can't even be compassionate. You're dumb at being dumb. And, you know, because of those cycles. And it is one of those things that you have, having a step-by-step process can help when that is a new and foreign thing to do.
Step-by-step. Baby steps.
Yay, cool. Baby steps. We will do that one next.
All right. So we'll do so
on Smart People Dumb Brain.
Say that again. I didn't hear you.
I said, we'll do that one next on the next episode of Smart People Dumb Brains. Yeah.
All righty. So we're out. Thank you.